It's easy to feel sure of ourselves when things are going our way, right? When that big project is succeeding or that promotion has come through or our lives are just proceeding according to plan. It's a lot more challenging to summon self-assurance when it feels like we're picking up the pieces after a loss or facing odds that are not in our favor. But the tough times are when confidence matters most. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Nate Zinser is director of the Performance Psychology Program at the United States Military Academy at West Point and a sports psychology mentor to elite athletes, which is to say he works with some of the most highly skilled individuals around. He believes that self-confidence is what separates the true legends from the almost-rans, and that confidence itself isn't just something we're born with or something we deserve after a win, but a skill we can all build that makes it possible for us to do our best work. He writes about this in his book, The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. Nate, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
You explained at the very beginning, confidence is not a guarantee, but it does make peak performance possible. Why is it impossible to do our very best if we don't feel self-assured?
If you don't feel self-assured, by definition, you'll be thinking of various things that might go wrong. You'll be preoccupied with the ramifications of a possible failure. And in so doing, you kind of fill the brain up with unnecessary thoughts, which will interfere with the smooth appreciation or perception of what is around you. It'll interfere with your ability to automatically recall the proper response for a given situation. And it will also create some tension in the muscles that govern your execution. In all these ways, self-doubt, worry, fear, or just over-preoccupation with mechanics can interfere with your performance, and it won't, by definition, be as good as it could be.
Your first chapter is all about what confidence is and what it is not, which implies that our understanding of confidence may be a little skewed. So what do we tend to misunderstand about it?
Several things. You alluded to it in your intro, the idea that confidence is something that we are born with, and henceforth there isn't much that we can do about it during the course of our lives. I would argue that confidence is something that we learn to get better and better at, or we learn to get worse and worse at it. It's a skill. It can be developed like any other skill or any other ability. That's a huge misconception. Another one is that confidence is this all-encompassing attitude that will govern every aspect of our lives, when the truth of the matter is that confidence is very situation-specific. You can be very confident in one aspect of your life and completely lacking in confidence in another. The good news, again, is that you can develop confidence in any particular aspect of your life that you care to. And third, relatedly, confidence is not some one-time successful experience. There's no single moment where you will suddenly blossom into full confidence and remain that way indefinitely. No. Confidence is subject to the ups and downs, to the highs and lows, to the slings and arrows of outraged fortune, as Shakespeare put it. So you have to keep working on it day by day, hour by hour, in order to assure that you are indeed at your best when you need to be. So those three misunderstandings are pretty common in our world.
Lots of us were raised to be wary of arrogance, right? And certainly most people prefer not to spend time around really conceited people. But you explain here there's no reason to think gaining self-confidence will turn us into braggarts, right?
Absolutely. That's perhaps a fourth major misconception, that confidence equals outspoken arrogance. Perhaps the popular image of a confident person, you know, seems to connote loudness, self-assuredness, a certain kind of movement in your body. But confidence is really an internal state. And all that chest pounding and self-aggrandizing, well, that's just posturing on the outside. It's important to realize that there are just as many quiet, introverted, yet very confident people as there are loud, outspoken, confident people. And if you happen to be the more quiet, polite, modest type, rest assured that generating a sense of certainty about yourself on the inside will not at all compromise your modesty, your courtesy, or your politeness.
You also explain that actual success requires both confidence and competence. If we think we're the best at something, but we haven't put in the work to gain the skills, we're not going to get very far, are we?
No, that would be a form of misplaced confidence. You certainly do need to do the work. You certainly do need to develop the various skills. And as you do so, it's just as important to reflect and recognize and acknowledge the improvements in your skill sets. Otherwise, you could have great skill, but you could still walk into a game, a match, a job interview, a presentation, an argument, professional or personal, lacking the certainty in the skills that you actually have. And that is what I have found to be so common in our world, that there is indeed plenty to trust and believe in, yet we haven't developed the process through which we can have that trust and that belief.
You have worked with some legendary folks who all are household names. Do you find that people are surprised when they come to you and say, hey, I need to work on my confidence. I'm great at this thing, but somehow I don't feel good about it.
I'm not surprised at all. Even people that we might watch on television on Sunday afternoons are just people like you and I. They may have remarkable physical gifts. They might have developed years and years to develop those gifts, yet in so many ways, they're just like everybody else. They have hopes and dreams. They have fears and doubts and worries. So it doesn't surprise me at all that some of these folks would come and say, yeah, I want to work on my attitude. I want to get really good at that.
A lot of us feel like we'll have confidence as soon as we achieve our goals. Why is that not a guarantee, even if we've done really big things?
Because it seems to always kick your confidence one step further down the road.
Hmm.
As soon as I get to this level, then I'll believe in myself. Well, we get to that level, and then the same person is going to say, well, okay, I'm here, but now I'm really worried about getting there. And so there's this constant delay of allowing oneself to feel good about one's experience. I think you have to be more in the moment. You have to be ready to accept where you are and feel certain about yourself to the extent of the ability that you have indeed developed, rather than constantly playing the waiting game. Someday I'll feel good. Someday I'll feel good. Someday I'll feel good.
A lot of people seem to talk about being their own harshest critic. And I think sometimes we talk about that as a way of saying, I care very much about quality. I hold myself to a high standard. Why is it not necessarily good for performance to be our own harshest critic?
Well, you certainly don't want to be your own harshest critic in the actual moment of performance, because that will only serve to tighten you. That will only serve to create momentary emotional tension, which turns into physical tension in the body. Being your own harshest critic on Monday morning for the Sunday afternoon football player, or the day after you take that test and you've gotten your results back, then you can indeed indulge and take advantage of that self-critical aspect in your psychology. And there's nothing wrong with that if it is done at the right time, in the right places, and to the right level of intensity. But carrying that critical mentality into the moment of performance, into the game, into the interview, into the speech or presentation that you're making, that will only serve to tighten you up and limit your ability to fully express what you have.
What can we learn from paying attention to our own weaknesses, and how can that help us build confidence?
Well, if we are honest about what we are not yet very good at, and we put the effort into improving our skills, improving our knowledge areas, and then reflect upon, look, I've learned this. look, I'm better at this aspect of my sport. It's that reflection on our improvements and our reflection on our continued investment of effort. Now we can add those thoughts about our improvements into our mental bank account so we can actually derive greater confidence by addressing some of our not quite great attributes yet.
And one thing you talk about is the importance of speaking about our achievements kind of in the present tense. So instead of imagining some future where we finally get as good as we hope to be, we focus on what we are able to control today.
Very true. We all tell ourselves stories about the things that we're good at, the things that we're bad at. And those stories, in so many ways, establish a ceiling or a limit to which we can rise, and indeed a barrier beyond which we won't rise. So I ask people to be very honest and talk to themselves as if they already have a certain skill. My cross-court backhand is deep and powerful. If you indeed want a deep and powerful cross-court backhand, why don't you affirm it? Why don't you say yes to it? That will serve as an energizing function to actually go out and practice it. So, in a way, we're encouraging ourselves to develop by acknowledging what it is that we want, and by owning it that way, it makes us much more likely to actually pursue that and train that skill with intense effort and intense attention.
So getting really good at anything we care very much about is going to require a whole lot of practice along the way. How do we handle plateaus when it feels like we're working just as hard as we ever were, but we're not making gains as fast as we were at the beginning?
Yeah, that's a funny thing about our nervous system, that even though we put consistent energy and effort into rehearsing certain skills and getting better at stuff, we don't always see an immediate payoff. What frustrates a lot of people is that they work hard and they say, you know, I used to be getting better and better week by week. I could really see my progress. I could really experience happening. But nowadays, now that I'm much older, it seems that I work for a really long time before anything changes, before I notice any improvement. And that's simply due to the fact that as you get better and better at something, your nervous system takes a little bit longer to take in all those new experiences, to process all your practice, to start reorganizing itself. It's kind of like getting a software upgrade, but the software upgrade doesn't happen as a result of a few clicks. We've probably run into the experience of upgrading our software, and it takes a few minutes for the wheels to turn, and then the new program is installed. Our nervous system is like that, but sometimes that reboot, that upgrade process, can take weeks. And it seems like we're getting nowhere. But in fact, as we are working hard, the upgrade is taking place. It's taking place while we are working. It seems like we're getting nowhere, but the nervous system is changing. And at some point, if we continue that level of effort, if we continue that level of enthusiasm, the nervous system process reaches a certain critical mass, and bingo, we experience that. Oh, there it is. We get that little aha moment, and that means that the software's been upgraded, and now we can enjoy that new level. And then, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to settle back on another plateau, and we got to keep working through that one, and keep working through that one, and then that aha moment will come again. It's just the way the software upgrades itself.
So we've been talking about, the software upgrading itself in terms of our skills. It's true of confidence too, right? It's not that we gain confidence one day and then for the rest of our lives we are a confident person, full stop. This is going to require ongoing effort.
Very much so. The big misconception is that once I achieve confidence, I'll have it forever across the board. No. We live in an imperfect world. We're all going to suffer some setbacks. We've got to continually work on this for as long as we are engaged in the pursuit of our personal success or personal excellence. I hope I'm not bursting anybody's bubble with that. I'm just trying to be realistic.
So how can we assess our progress toward confidence at the end of every day?
Again, I think we have to be honest with ourselves. Honest in terms of, okay, what do I need to be working on tomorrow to keep going? But very importantly, where did I put in good effort today? What little successes might I have achieved today? What kind of progress do I seem to be making in my sport or in my profession? And that daily reflection on effort, success, progress, and then a daily reflection, okay, what's important for me to get after tomorrow? It's doing that on a continuous basis that allows us to benefit maximally from our past experience and also energize us to go forward into tomorrow.
How do great performers learn to apply kind of mental filters so that they are not distracted in the moment by negative thoughts and experiences, so that they put those off until they're reflecting at the end of the day?
Well, that is indeed the discipline. The idea is that I am in the moment. I am in the game. I am in the performance. I don't have the luxury of being self-critical about myself. If I do make a goof in the early part of the game, I might allow myself 5 seconds of self-criticism, but then I have to step back, take a breath, be able to talk to myself like my very best friend would, and then step up so I can throw the next pitch or I can play the next point in the tennis match and be ready to go. It's a matter of self-regulation, willingness to do it over and over again as many times as necessary. 70 times if you're on the golf course, 65 times if you're the quarterback in the football game, as many times as is required in a five-set tennis match, such as we witnessed just the other day between Medvedev and the eventual champion, Rafael Nadal.
And Nate, when I think about the work that you do with cadets at West Point, I mean, you're training them to have confidence for situations in which life or death may be on the line.
This is true. The first thing you have to be able to do if you're going to lead anyone is lead yourself. You need to be in control of your own mind. You need to be in control of your own emotions if you are going to direct people and serve as a good model. It is a long time saying here at West Point that on the fields of friendly strife, referring to basketball courts, football fields, etc. On the fields of friendly strife are sown the seeds that on other fields, on other days, will bear the fruits of victory. So the idea of training yourself through your required physical training at West Point, through whatever competitive sport you might choose to play, you are deliberately training yourself to develop skill. You are training yourself to bring out confidence in the moment. It's part of your development as a leader. Every cadet has to take a mandatory physical fitness test twice a year. And your class rank depends on that. Every cadet is taking a mandatory course load. So many cadet, every cadet is actually judged on their military performance in their respective companies each and every semester. So there are constant tests, constant performances that are required. And so the idea is you better get good at performing at your max, because when we get out there into the real army, and if you happen to be deployed, we're going to need you to be at your best for a long period of time. So we better practice the mental skills that will be required should we get there.
And you've seen it time and again where two cadets may have nearly identical skills, let's say for physical fitness. One has good confidence, the other lacks it. Why is the confident person better positioned to overcome obstacles that might challenge both of those people?
Because the confident person is going to be telling herself three quarters of the way through a 2 mile run, long strides, breathe big, we can do this, put it down, we've got this. Whereas the unconfident person is going to say, gosh, this hurts. I don't know how long I can keep this up. Gosh, I wish I didn't have to do this. And it's that negative self-talk that's just going to tighten up the muscles of the latter person. But the former person who's telling herself, stride out, breathe big, bear down, you've got this, keep it up, that's going to open the musculature. That's going to allow the blood to get out to those muscles. That's going to help the breathing. So, in a way, talking to yourself effectively, as we've been indicating, influences your physical state, and that physical state certainly has a big impact on your physical performance.
Nate, you explained that we should envision our future to build confidence as we build skills and experience. And you also say that it helps to be really specific when we envision our achievements. What kinds of details should we include, and why are those details so helpful?
Well, the whole idea of envisioning success is to accommodate or acclimatize your nervous system to the environment and to the setting that you're going to be in. And that accommodation process is best achieved with a lot of detail. So, yeah, it's one thing to have a vague idea that you'll be giving a presentation to a certain kind of audience, but it's much more impactful in terms of getting your nervous system ready to deliver that presentation in that environment, if you have really good input to give it. What's the room going to look like? What's the quality of the lighting going to be? Where will the audience be seated? How is the room to be arranged? Where will you be in the room? Do you have a podium? Will you be at a desk? Will there be a microphone? All these things, if you can get a clear vision of those, it allows your nervous system to kind of experience what it's going to be experiencing, but experiencing it ahead of time. In a way, and this is very significant, your nervous system doesn't know the difference between an actual stimulus and a vividly imagined stimulus. I'm sure I can make every one of your listeners salivate a little bit by getting them to really think about what it's like to cut into a lemon and bring it up to their face and smell it and feel it and then just delicately tasting it and then taking a big bite into it. Gosh, your mouth is going to water. Well, why is your mouth watering? Your mouth doesn't need any saliva. There's no food actually going into your mouth. But if you can create a fairly detailed mental representation of that food going into your mouth, your mind thinks it's actually happening and your body will respond. It's the same experience we want to have before a game, before a performance, before taking a test, before giving a presentation. If we can create a detailed mental representation of that experience, in a way, we are fooling our nervous system into believing that we're already there. Which means if you do this a few times and then you indeed walk into that situation, there's a certain degree of familiarity and comfort. That's the kind of feeling that you want to have. Sure, there'll still be some excitement. Sure, your body will still fire up a little bit because it's an important performance, but there'll be an edge of familiarity and a degree of certainty about it that you won't have if you don't do that kind of mental preparation, that kind of envisioning of the performance you desire.
Whether we do it or not, I think most of us can envision what a perfect performance or game might look like. Is it helpful to also run through the things that could conceivably go wrong?
It's always a good idea to have, I guess you could call it some backup plans in your mind, some sense of, okay, if this happens, I'm going to respond this way. If that happens, I'm going to respond that way. In this way, you prepare yourself to be comfortable when things do indeed go wrong. There's several stories that I share in the book about athletes at very big moments being suddenly confronted by a most unexpected situation, having a delay, or having to sit for 5 minutes when you're about to go on to the wrestling mat for the national semifinal, or coming out to throw the hammer in the Olympic trials and discovering that the surface of the circle that you have to spin to generate centrifugal force to throw the hammer with has been altered, so it's much rougher and much more difficult to move on. Being able to anticipate some of these possible distractions and difficulties and having a plan on how to overcome them allows you to enter into a situation with a lot more certainty about yourself. And I'll add, nobody expected that surface in the hammer throwing circle to be roughed up, but because the athlete had done so much visualization of other possible scenarios, being ahead, being behind, having different difficult weather conditions to compete in, because he had been so good at planning for all these other contingencies, when something completely unexpected came out of the blue, he was very smooth in how he responded to it and threw better and better and better as the trials went on.
If success requires both confidence and competence, Nate, how can we know when we've practiced enough to take the field, walk into a meeting, sit down to take a test, whatever the challenge might be?
How do we know if we've practiced enough? Boy, that is a great question. And my answer is, maybe you don't know for certain, but you don't have to know for certain. No matter how much practice or preparation you've done, I suppose it's possible that you could always do more. So it's not a matter of, God, did I do everything? Did I do everything? Did I do everything? It's a matter of, hey, I did what I did, and I am going to believe that what I did is enough. I am enough for this moment. I am enough to step into this arena against this particular opponent or that particular opponent. I'm enough to step up and give a presentation on this topic. I may not have done everything to prepare, but in that moment, you have to make the decision that you are enough. It's just as simple and just as difficult as that.
If the basis for confidence starts to be cultivated in childhood, what are we doing wrong in the way we educate kids about confidence and the way we should own or not own the things we're really good at?
Well, I think it's important to allow kids to own the things that they are good at. I think it's very important to get kids to look at what they are doing well, what they are improving at, rather than just drawing their attention on the test papers to those red X's for the five or six things out of the 20 questions that they got wrong. We are kind of socialized to look at the worst in ourselves because of those sorts of experiences. I know we have to be realistic. Okay, yes, I answered 80% of the questions. That gives me a B. I'm striving for an A. I have to study more. I've got to look at where I made a mistake, look at what I missed, derive a study strategy to address that and move forward. But I got to give myself credit for those 80% that I got right, or else I just think, oh gosh, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not getting the A. Come on, let's have a little compassion. Let's practice a little bit of forgiveness. That is energizing in the last analysis.
Is there room for comparing ourselves with the performances of other people as we're trying to gain confidence?
Yeah, there's room, but again, it's a matter of perspective, okay? If you are looking at somebody and putting them up on a pedestal as some, you know, godlike example to follow, then you're always putting yourself in second place. If you look at somebody who's, you know, perhaps runs faster, lifts more weight than you do, gets certain grades, then you can scratch your head and say, okay, now, how'd they get that way? What can I do to close the gap between where I am and where I see that person? If you can use it constructively as energy and as information to help you, well, then fine. But putting someone up on a pedestal as sort of an impossible standard to reach is only detrimental. That only holds you back.
So we don't want them to be a mystery figure. We want them to be someone that we can emulate sort of directly.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not kid ourselves, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody that you see as, a Super Bowl champion or an Olympic gold medalist, they're just human like you and I. They got their foibles. They've got their difficulties. If I have to compete against somebody that the sports media or the ranking system has put way above me, well, I'm going to bring them down to my level. I'm going to tell myself that guy, that gal has to compete against me. I'm going to do what I do. And it's up to them to match me at my level. I'm not going to try to magically elevate myself to some imagined standards of their level. I'm going to do what I do. I'm
Dr.
going to do
Nate
the best
Zinsser.
job of myself.
Dr. Nate Zinsser is director of the Performance Psychology Program at West Point and author of The Confident Mind, a battle-tested guide to unshakable performance. Nate, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Chris. It's been great, and my best to all your listeners.
Thank you. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.